I think it was Inarruk, and Conor Murray threw the ball back and kicked it. Just look at it soaring through the air. And honestly, I was only on the pitch for 7 minutes, but when that went over, it was the best feeling I've ever had on a rugby pitch in my life. Like, it literally was. Like, I'm talking as good as like the feeling after having our first child. Like, it was just, and my wife won't be happy I said that, yeah. But genuinely, it was just incredible.
House of Rugby Ireland, here on Joe. Game changed.
Hello and welcome to House of Rugby here on Joe. I'm Eimear Constantine and I'm joined in studio by Fergus McFadden, and we swapped out one Ulster man for another Ulster man and former Ulster and Ireland player. Chris, thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure to be here.
You rushed down the road after doing commentary on BBC today for the game.
Yeah, I was doing the radio, so I've watched it in detail. Like everyone, I was kind of hoping to be driving down a bit more upbeat. It was a busy old day, but it's great to be in and hopefully chat, put a bit of positive spin on today's performance.
And you're happy to get out of the house as well?
Yeah, it's been great to get out of the house, but like Ferg, I've got two young kids, any excuse to get out at the moment is great. And to be able to talk about, obviously, something I love, rugby, so it's great to be here.
I know for a few moments there, you almost forgot there was a pandemic on this weekend. I think everyone was really excited for the rugby this weekend. Unfortunately, Ireland rallied and they tried and, you know, battled through the performance day today, but down to 14 men early in the game. After 13 minutes, you know, and led 13-6 at half time, but they could not keep Wales out in the second half. They lost 21-16, but that scoreline is not even half of the story. So let's get straight into it. Not an ideal start with the red card after 13 minutes, Chris.
No, certainly not. Disappointing way for some, one of your, you know, key players, obviously Peter Manny, who's brought so much positivity to Irish rugby, made so many big moments, but that obviously was such a disappointing start for him. A moment of not madness. As a back rower, I know that you see an opposition shirt and you want to completely smash it. And unfortunately for him, he just, you know, the elbow caught the face, and there was no other decision to be made apart from the red card. So, really.
I think there was no malice in it, though, wasn't there?
No malice, but you know, Pete would have been going to that game so hyped up, and as I said, you want to see an opposition shirt and you want to just smash it and take someone's head off, and unfortunately it went against him.
I think it's so clear cut these days as well. There's no grey area anymore. You know, there was no, I think even when he was communicating with the TMO, it was very much, these are the laws, this is what happened, and it was very, very clear cut.
Yeah, it's a very difficult one when it happens, because it happens so fast there, and you can guarantee that with Paul O'Connell coming into the camp, he was driving kind of, because he learned an awful lot under Joe Schmidt about cleaning past the ball. And it looked like their ruck was, well, their ruck all day, I thought, was the best it looked in a long time. And Pete obviously was looking to just smash that guy who was on top of the ball. And unfortunately, his head was just so low. I definitely think there was no intention behind it. And I hope he doesn't pick up any sort of a ban, because I think the red card was probably enough and was unfortunate for us to pick it up at that early stage.
I think so. 14 men, though, not an easy way to get through the game, but there were some phenomenal performances. I suppose we'll start with the positives of the game. So like you said, the ruck was good. You know, they did sort out their line out. Who stood out for you today?
You know, everyone, so many players stood out of an Irish perspective. I think there's no doubt they all had to go to the well. They all give everything, because you're making up for that lost player at such an early point of a game. Wales couldn't exploit Ireland really at all. I think it was an average Wales performance. With the man down, you'd expect them to up the ante, up the tempo, and it was the Irish players that actually took it to Wales and at the end of that first half, which was fantastic to see. So many big carries from Stander, from Henderson. Tadhg Byrne was just outstanding. Van der Flyer, you know, some of his carries and what the work rate he brought. So everyone made up for Peter Malley being off. And I really thought that there was just a brilliant belief going into that half-time. They'd managed the game so well in regards to territory and keeping possession. And it was actually the Welsh team that looked, I thought, shattered going into half-time. When Tadhg Byrne scored that try from Henshaw's break on the blind side, if you watch it back on the widescreen, there must be about five Irish players around the corner. So if Tadhg Byrne hadn't picked, anyone could have been walking in, and the Welsh players, they weren't folding, and I think that's a great sign. If you look at opposition, how quickly they fold, how quickly they are to get the set, and it was just a shame that, the fatigue in the Irish team in the second half came to the forced errors and the penalty count to go against them.
I think during the week, Peter Manny said that, you know, everyone has to train as if they're playing, and everyone needs to know the plays, and everyone needs to be, you know, pushing the standards. And today we saw the impact of the bench and how important it is that those bench guys slot in. And like you said, Ian Henderson was phenomenal after James Ryan went off injured. But, you know, they were down to 14 players and the team managed to... They dealt with it really well. Robbie Henshaw make an open side flanker look very easy. You know, like he was
pretty sure he didn't know where to bind. And I was looking at him on his first chrome there. I think it was around 10 meters out on the right in the first half, and he went on. You could see he was almost looking over at Josh van der Vleer, seeing where exactly he needs to join. But
if there's one man you want on the side of a scrum, that's Ferg, definitely. Head guard ready.
The headband on. Yeah. Exactly. I probably belong there, realistically.
Too right.
There was actually a few weeks ago in training, they made us swap around, and forwards were backs and backs were forwards, and the forwards were picking and going. It's like, backs don't pick and go. We had a notion where to put heads and arms, and there was a maul and everything. So I don't want that day to happen.
You learned a lot that day.
Where that ever has to wear that.
You learned what rugby was properly about then.
Yeah, not a clue what was going on. But, you know, some phenomenal performances. And like Josh van der Vleer, you know, for someone who didn't get a lot of game time in the Autumn Nations, you know, Will Connors came on and was tremendous again. But van der Vleer, one of his better games today.
Yeah, I'm not sure what his stats were, but between Josh van der Vleer and Tadhg Byrne and Robbie Henshaw, like, they were phenomenal performances. And just so unfortunate they had to end up on the losing side because they didn't deserve to. And I think it was James, the loose head for Wales, got the man of the match.
Yeah,
his stats were really good as well. But right across the board, I mean, listen, it was a really, really experienced Welsh side. That's what Wayne Pivak went for. He went for the old guard, and it worked out for him in the end. I agree with Chris. I didn't think they looked like they were getting over the gain line very much with the ball in hand. I think even George North's try was from a spilled pass that popped into, Tipuric managed to flick it out. And
he got outside Henderson.
Yeah, George North got in. And then the other try they scored was quick hands and Reece Amott, just, it was a phenomenal finish in the corner. So between those two chances, they were clinical, but really, for the amount of pressure Ireland put on, I think they really deserved to probably have more on the scoreboard. And it probably that being down to 14 men probably told in the last 20 minutes.
Yeah, and even for Zamet's try, like, it was Tadhg Furlong that was the one that was over covering. And like the work rate that the team, not just, you know, not the pack, it was genuinely like everyone was just gave it. I think that was what was so heartbreaking at the end, was that they left, you know, they left everything out there. They carried so hard. They never gave up. Like, it was the 83rd, 84th minute, and, you know, it was just a really gutsy performance that, like, your heart broke for the players. Like, what's it like as a player knowing that you've given it all?
Yeah, I think, like, it really galvanised the team. I think especially someone like Pete, who, you know, has won so many big moments for Ireland in the past. If you're a player on that pitch and someone who, you know, you're very close to has made a mistake, like all rugby players do, Galvin, you want to win. Obviously, you want to win always, but you know that there's so much at stake. And I think we really saw that team came together and gave it everything they could have to try get the win. Because, as I said, we were talking here about Peter Manny, who's one of Ireland's best players over such a long time, who's won so many big moments for Ireland. And yes, unfortunately, this day wasn't his day to remember. So yeah, that's the biggest positive. Tadhg Furlong coming back, you know, playing so little rugby, yeah, to be able to get across the other side of the pitch to, you know, that forearm, you know, another day that knocks the ball out. Yeah. And those are the small moments in games that can change. So for me, to see him back and so fit and you know, make an impact, fantastic to see. And you go through the team sheet, every player, I don't think, no, a few unforced errors and yes, a few silly penalties, but again, it all comes down to they're so fatigued by that stage in the second half because of being the man down. So lots of disappointment, lots of positives as well from the game.
Lots of positives, but I suppose we have to look at the negatives and look at where Ireland lacked and what let them down today. And it was just, there was key moments of the game, like, even, you know, Ringrose trying to offload where he knocked it on. It resulted in the Welsh try, you know, forcing passes that weren't on. There was things, you know, Clint kicks missed a touch. And obviously at the very end, the a pass from Billy Burns, you know, put them way behind the advantage line. And then obviously him missing the kick to touch. You know, those are the crucial moments that you need to be making in games like that.
Yeah, but I think in the balance of the game, I think if you looked at the stats, Wales probably made more unforced errors for the amount of ball they had than Ireland did. Like, I'm not sure what the stats were, but Ireland, I think their carries were...
They were double almost, yeah.
Definitely in around twice as many as the Welsh. That sums the game up, and that's a man down as well. So, yeah, there was some errors throughout the game, but I thought... The overriding feeling for me was that I'm not so sure Wayne Barnes had a great game for Ireland in the second half either. I think there was a very important penalty towards the end that we're talking about before we got on the show, where Tadhg Byrne was over the ball, and it seemed like the ball was out. You know, but that penalty was given against Ireland. That's 3 points, and if you roll it forward then, and Billy Burns is kicking for the corner, he can kick for goal there if that penalty wasn't given, and I don't think it was a penalty. Again, another one that is up for debate would be towards the end. Ireland try and throw it out the back through Billy Burns, and Tompkins clearly just slaps the ball down. Like, that's, if that wasn't the 79th minute, I think that's a yellow card. So from that play, they kick to touch, and if they're a man down in the centre there, it just creates so much more space. So a couple of decisions that didn't go Ireland's way from Wayne Barnes' decision making, I'm not so sure they were correct.
Yeah, Wayne Barnes statistically has given Ireland two times more penalties than all of the refs have over the past decade. Would you look at referees prior to a game and analyse that and know what certain referees do?
Yeah, I mean, especially test match rugby, not so much. You touched on it a bit provincial when I was playing, but obviously games moved on so much more. I'm sure you would go into even more detail. But with Joe Smith, I mean, yeah, 100%, there was a massive meeting on the small talking points that they had to go to. And it did. It was important because it definitely planted seeds in your head about your real hot spots that they were looking for. And it just, yeah, a lot of it is making sure that... you know, where's the first penalty going to go to? You know, is it going to be that first scrum? What's he looking for? What's his go-to, trigger points? So I'm surprised by that stat with Wayne Barnes. You know, it is difficult to listen to that. And I agree with Ferg. You know, even, I think it was George North, that it was a real cynical play where he pushed the ball on the ground penalty. And maybe at a different time in the game, that's a yellow card, another yellow card. And then at the end of this first half, when Robbie Henshaw came off with his HIA, that tackle, you know, that's a dangerous tackle, the head collision, reckless. Could that have gone a different way? So, look, these are the things that if buts and maybes. I think probably Wayne Barnes, in hindsight, maybe because in the second half, Ireland were given a string of penalties, and his mindset was going, well, this is just sort of maybe balancing it out. I'm not so sure. But you don't want to have to rely on a referee's decision to change the outcome. And it was always going to be such an uphill battle from the first half.
Here's what Johnny Sexton had to say about Wayne Barnes leaving his cards in his pocket for the Welsh lads. And here's Andy Farrell talking about that Pete red card.
Yeah, you said it. But like, it's just clear. For me, it's clear. The Tompkins sticking his hand out. The hand in the ruck. I don't know what else to say. I'm blaming ourselves for the loss, but when you show the bravery that we showed, they're tough to take. But again, it's not a surprise really.
I haven't yet, but I will do. I shook his hand, and I'm coming talking to you boys, but I will speak to him obviously. Look, it's not the reason we lost the game. We've all missed touch before. I suppose he'll be gutted, obviously, because of the magnitude of the last minute or whether we've got a chance to win the game at the death there. But he'll learn from this. Well, obviously, he's gutted as well. Guys don't do this on purpose, you know, to get sent off and hamper the performance of the team. You know, they care about the team and the teammates deeply, you know, so obviously Pete's hurting at this moment in time, but he's done a lot of good things for us, hasn't he, in the past, and I'm sure he'll do the same for us in the future.
As a forward, you've played with Paul O'Connell. Have you seen any of, you know, his work implemented in the team today?
Well, yes, I guess. I mean, the line-out was run really slick. Line-out defence, there were some really big moments. Gosh, it's very early to really say, oh, that is a Paul O'Connell moment. I think the time will tell. I think the biggest thing for me is just the relationships he obviously has with so many of those the players already. You know, there's a massive respect between himself and Henderson and James Ryan. So it's a wealth of knowledge he's going to bring. The forwards did really well. Whether that is directly towards Paul O'Connell or not, I know as a player, if I was still set up and Paul O'Connell wasn't going to be my new forwards coach. I mean, you look at all the one percenters and the fine margins. Well, you want to play for a coach, and there's no one else you want to play for more than Paulie.
Yeah,
you know, you knew that no matter what he says to you, what he demands from you, he has done it. He has been there and done it. He was the ultimate pro when I played. And yeah, I just think it's a great addition to this Irish team and a great side story. But to say that was the Irish pack, you know, did they have a great performance just because of Paulie? Well, I think it's too early to say, and I think he would probably admit that too. You know, he really needs to stamp his authority, and it's going to take time. And the bigger factor is probably going to be how this pack's going to bounce back from this. You know, will the psychology set up what Paul brings? We've had a tough day, Test match rugby. It hasn't gone our way. Well, how do we bounce back quickly? Because it's such a short turnaround. As a forward, you're gonna they're gonna be hurting after today. That was a test match today that the pack had to deliver. And it's whether Paul can get them going for next week.
I think the ruck was better though, and I agree with you that, you know, they've only had 12 days together. Andy Farrell was saying beforehand, so it's not enough time for, you know, Paulie to implement what he wants to bring to the team. It's going to take a bit more time than that, but. And the expectations are so high from the public that Paul O'Connell's in, he's going to make, you know, it takes time to embed that kind of twist he's going to bring to the team. But I think the ruck was better than the autumn anyway. I think it was Tipperick had that clear turnover in the second half where he took the ball off Johnny on the ground. But I don't think they had many turnovers. And for the back row and pack they have, you know, the threats they have over the ball, I thought that was a lot better. So if they can bring that into the French game, that would be huge.
Yeah, absolutely. A man that, you know, hasn't that much experience playing in obviously his first Six Nations game, James Lowe. How did you feel he performed today?
Yeah, I think, I mean, Test match rugby as a winger is so brutal, you know. I think that I thought he had a good game. I think that some of his kicking, having that left footed option in the back line now when Rob Kearney is gone is key. And he's got one of the biggest boots in the world. So some of his clearances were you know, really impressive in the first half. He got us out of a fair bit of trouble. Some of his carries were brilliant. You know, that carry he had just before Robbie Henshaw made that break, he took the ball off the scrum and got over the gain line by 10 metres. So such a hard man to stop. Like, even when two guys hit him when he's got a head of a speed up. So... listen, there was that one moment probably where Rhys Sammet scored in the corner. Could he have stayed out? I'd say Andy Farrell would look back on the clip with the lads and the backs on Monday and say he probably should have. But people probably forget that it was George North coming onto that ball. He was getting over the gain line all day long. Yeah. He was getting his hands free all day long. So James probably wanted to try get in there, shut off the ball. And, you know, in fairness, North showed good skill to flick it to Halfpenny, who managed to get it to Rhys Sammet. So that would probably be a moment he'll look back on.
It's a lose-lose there, really, isn't it? As a winger, you know, you have to make a decision. You just have to back your decision and just go for it. And if it works out, great. You know, if you end up shooting and get man and ball, it's
very
great.
Much so, very much so. And the amount of times James shoots and does get man and ball, so fair play to the Welsh. The George North showed great skill there, flicked it on and... But yeah, that was probably a big enough moment in the match.
Yeah, what about Hugo Keenan? I don't think he made any mistake today.
He has just been brilliant, hasn't he? I mean, when he came on the scene, you know, you watch him and you go, is he too young to be thrown in the mix? I'm sure you would have obviously trained with him a lot more.
Well, I was saying that initially because he was taking my place.
Oh, well, that's it. Yes, of course.
He's way too young.
But no, he has just been, you know, so safe, so slick. He's elusive. Counter-attack ability. So yeah, I just think he's been a fantastic find, and he just seems like he's no problems being there for such a young guy. So there is there's good selection headaches in the back three, but for me, I think Keenan is definitely, you know, when Rob Carney retired, you go, who's going to really, you know, be that safe as houses at the back? And he certainly, you know, filled that shirt, I think, at the moment. And he, you know, he's only going to get better and better as he plays more with the players around him, and those combinations start happening. So, yeah, he'll be certainly one of the shining lights of today's game, I think.
Yeah, he just did the simple things right. You know, he was just flawless, really. And in a game like today where you needed consistency, and he really did deliver that. I suppose looking on to next weekend, they've got the French. We'll chat about the French game in part two, but just, you know, it's a quick turnaround. The bodies will be hurting. A lot of carries today, a lot of metres gained today. Two HIAs, James Ryan had injured and with a head injury, and Johnny Sexton went off injured as well. What kind of selection headaches are we looking at next weekend?
Well, yeah, they'll have to see what the injury profile is. Obviously, Peter Manley's going to be out as well, so there's another back row decision to be made. Someone who I think, you know, even was hard done by today was Reece Ruddock, who has been outstanding, and what a great story for him to come back. So, you know, he's certainly going to be someone who, you know, do they make a few key changes to the starting panel because of, you know, they've been knocked, as you said, a short turnaround. Might it be an idea to throw some really fresh legs in? You know, you've got to say Tag Furlong after his cameo. You know, he's going to be really important against the French. So yeah, look, there is going to be big decisions to be made, as there always is. I think the centre combination with Robbie Henshaw and Ringrose, for me, like their ability just to win those extra wee yards, their footwork, you think, you know, there's a wall on them, you think they're not going to make any yards, and their ability to do that. So I think that was a real big positive for today.
What do you think about 10? You know, will it be Billy Burns next week? Will it be Byrne after that kick today? Like, it's a bad mistake to make.
Yeah, it is, and you know, I really felt for the guy because you know, Ireland had put themselves in the position. But I think Johnny was quoted saying after the game, when, you know, the tens are the ones that hold the responsibility in those moments, and there's huge responsibility. And you know, Billy's obviously looking, going, am I going to try, you know, win a line out for us in the last play of the game on the 22, or am I going to try and win it as close to the line as possible? So he went for it, and that's what he had to do. And unfortunately, he didn't catch the kick perfectly. So will that affect Andy Farrell's decision-making for the next game? You'd imagine so, probably, because, you know, it probably was a tight enough call between himself and Ross. So it's hard to know. At the same time, you don't want to scapegoat a guy for one mistake. There was loads of mistakes from the whole team. So it would be nice to see him get another opportunity, because it was really unfortunate for him that the game had to finish like that for him. But at the same time, I think Ross Byrne has been, you know, he has been brilliant for Leinster at any opportunity he has had, whether it's coming off the bench or starting in big matches. And, you know, I think he'd also be a brilliant replacement for Johnny if he can't play.
Yeah. And talk us through the difference, I suppose, in a line-out, and like a difference of a line-out on the 5 as opposed to the 22 in the 83rd minute.
Yeah, obviously it's huge. Ireland score a lot of tries from Maul, and a lot of tries from line-out in general, but definitely from Maul. And, you know, I think if you look back at Sexton in the first half, he had a chance to kick the ball and he went for it. He went as far as he could, and, you know, he was inches off going out, 5 metres from the try line. They kept it in, and next minute we're back in our 10 metres. So I think if someone like Johnny Sexton is able to make a mistake, you know, it happens to everybody. I guess it's just, obviously, Johnny has a lot behind him. Billy, that was his moment to really grab this game and deliver for them. And I think Johnny was actually quoted, I think he said to Billy to go for it as well. So in Billy's head, he was like, right, I'm just going to get this ball as close as I can. So yeah, look, he is a great player. And if we get a try, if we get a line out there, then yes, you put a pretty strong bet on that we're going to score from them all. And it is a big difference. Like, if you're the difference of a 15 metre out from a 5 metre out, it is huge psychologically. You know, as a defensive line out, when you're going to stop them all, you know, you're more likely to hit it early, you're more likely to give away that cheap penalty. And Ireland are so good, even if they don't get from them all, you know that they're going to keep the possession, and they're very, very good scoring tries from short range, just like Leinster are. So Yeah, the gamble just didn't work out for them, unfortunately. And if Johnny had, just like that in the first half, Johnny had kicked the ball and we did get out there, you'd back us to have scored then too, and then it's a totally different dynamic. So it'd be interesting to see now, you know, what's going to happen next week in regards to that.
Yeah, let's say Henderson, or let's say James Ryan passes the HIA, and Henderson had a great performance today, but then so did Byrne. Like, you can't, you know, it's tough to leave them off. Do you see Byrne maybe moving to the back row, or what kind of changes do you think they'll make next weekend?
You've got to have that kind of discussion was forgotten about, I think, for a while. And yeah, like, Hendy played a lot of his rugby early on at six. And as you said, Tyke Byrne's played quite a bit at six. So maybe do you go, right, well, you know, you're going to miss Peter Manny too, so there's another line-out operator gone. So maybe if James Ryan is fit, do you do that? And when we come against, like, leading into the Six Nations, it was all about how Ireland going to compete with France and England, big, big power games. Well, is it a case of maybe just getting their best? Do you not worry about a combination just as much, and do you just try to get your best players, your most powerful players on the pitch? So maybe that is something that they might go for. You know, Van der Flyer and Connors bring something, you know, geez, they're world-class sevens. But maybe is there a dynamic shift of what they could do with that back five? Because, you know, it is going to get, you know, the big teams are coming our way. And how do you match this? The French pack is formidable. And how do we impose ourselves on them?
It means a taller guy jumping in the line-out as well. You know, yeah, like a Hendy or a Tighe at six, you know. But at the same time, back to your point earlier on in the conversation, like, Reece Ruddock has played so well. It's quite hard. And Hendy made such an impression off the bench. So if James passes a HIA, like, I would say you'd go Tyke Byrne, James Ryan and Reece Ruddock. You know, he jumps quite well for Leinster in the line-out a
lot. For a big man. And what, Keelan Doris, I mean, I don't know. What's his situation? I mean, he was obviously missed massively.
I think I read somewhere he was going to see a neurologist. Was it over in the UK somewhere? Okay. So that's not a very good sign, is it?
So
really,
it's unlikely for next week anyway. But he's been unbelievable. So that was huge. He would have been massive today, obviously, as well. So,
But if you have Hendy, whether he's starting or whether he's coming off the bench, like, he made such a huge impact coming off the bench. You know, usually guys come in and they ease into a match. Like, and he had a turnover. Really crucial turnover in the first half, getting over the ball, and
but he does it every time. You know, he's been so injury prone, but he doesn't need, like, whenever I don't know about yourself, but whenever I got injured and he came back, you know, you just wanted to feel your way back in because it took you a bit of time. He's okay. It's European Cup, no problem. Throw me in. Test match rugby, no problem.
He just didn't need the practice. He was just straight
the guy's
ready
just,
for
like,
it.
Doesn't faze him, and he just goes for it.
Another man, Tyke Fairline.
Yeah. Exactly, like, yeah, these players just don't seem to need, you know, whether it's the conditioning that they're getting done off the pitch but the mindset even to be up to that speed, decisions under pressure, they just seem to cope so well with being thrown into it, which is really positive, especially for someone who is obviously very, you know, more injury prone than others.
I think the debate probably for the coaches that are sitting around is going to come down to how the bodies are as well, because, like, it's a 5-day turnaround for Ireland, 6-day turnaround for France, and really, you know, France did ring in the changes after around 50, 60 minutes. DuPont was off with the Man of the Match award after 60 minutes or so, like, pretty impressive, and, you know, he'll be very fresh along with the others, and that game just wasn't as attritional as, like, the games against Wales and Cardiff are notoriously one of the toughest physically. That's what everyone always says about going over there. You come out of the place battered, whether you've won or lost, and it just depends how the bodies are and how the guys recover. I'd say that'll be a big bearing point for the coaches as to who they go with.
Yeah. What about Wales today, though? I know we're talking a lot about Ireland, but, like, will Wales topple the big, you know, the big guns, the Englands, and not England anymore, but, you know, the Frances? Like, will Wales go ahead and will they win this?
I don't think we've learned an awful lot about Wales today, to be honest. I think their inability to exploit Ireland, being a man down, you know, I think is poor. And in saying that, you know, you look at that spine, that Welsh team, and if they click and if, you know, they have world-class players, although, you know, a lot of them are getting the older age. I don't know whether, like, my wife said to me earlier, which I don't know where she heard this from, but apparently Alwyn Jones has more caps than all of the Italian team, which I don't know where she heard that from. I don't know if she's lying, and she doesn't watch rugby, so I don't know where she got this from. But that's so that's, you know, if you got someone like Alwyn Jones,
You know, do you see Italians had a tough enough day at the office without your missus?
I know, and she's put out a fire. I don't know why she doesn't like the Italian team. But yeah, like I just think, you know, Dan Lydiate as well. Obviously, it's a sad story, him coming off his knee. I don't know. I just don't think the Wales, psychologically, yes, they got a good win today against Ireland, but I can't see them being. I don't think that they have what it takes to go and push on. I think Scotland, I know we're probably going to go on Scotland soon. I wish we'd talk way more about Scotland, but you know, from what they produce, if they can produce that every week, then yes, you get excited. I don't think if you're a Welsh fan, really, are you that excited about what they pulled off today? I don't think so.
Yeah, well, it's an open book after round one anyway. Okay, great stuff. We'll take a short break and chat about the weekend's other games there. To take you there, here's some more of what Johnny Sexton and Andy Farrell had to say after the game.
I said to him, Billy, you got to go for it. And he did. And like I went for one as well in the second half. Because when you're chasing the game, you're 8 points down. Or when Billy was taking the kick, we were 5 points down. You got to put it 5 metres out. Like that's when you scored a try. If you put it 10 metres out, a good maul very rarely gets over. So, you know, he goes for it. Other days, you're the hero. You stick it right in the five. And it's the life of a number 10. You know, it can come down to, you know, small margins, and but I thought he did very well in the other parts of the game, and that's one moment. You know, there was plenty through that second half and the first half that we could have done better. But in saying that, it's tough when you're playing with 14 men. I've been there, you know, as a 10, like I said, you have moments where you're the hero, you have moments where you're the villain, because you put yourself on the. You put yourself in those moments, and that's the responsibility that you have. And like I said, if you kick the ball onto the 22, I think that would have been worse than going for it. And you know, to go and properly try and stick it 5 metres out, didn't come off from, but he'll learn from it and he'll go again.
Well, you know, I was saying to the lads that they'll feel sorry for themselves for a couple of hours, and they'll bring the best version of themselves into work tomorrow, because there's a lot of us in the group that's been involved in enough Six Nations to know that Six Nations is not won on the first day. From here on in, we've got to be clinical, more clinical, and give the performances of our lives to be in the battle to win the competition. It's as simple as that. We've got a very good French side coming over next week, and I suppose coming over to the Aviva, we'll back ourselves against anyone there.
House of Rugby Ireland. Tell us what you think by comment and rating us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Google Podcasts.
France racked up 50 points in their championship opener against Italy, but all the talk on Saturday was about Scotland's 11-6 win over England. The first time they've beaten England at Twickenham since 1983, when none of us were born. Lads, what did you make of that one?
Yeah, it was obviously the highlight of the weekend, wasn't it? I wish we'd had a full show on that game instead of the Irish Wales game.
She started on a high.
Yeah, exactly.
England getting beaten.
Yeah, listen, wasn't it just brilliant for Scotland to pull off for something that's, you know, hasn't happened, for, as you said, for such a long time. The way they went about it, I mean, they could have beaten England by more.
Or they could have battled it.
Well, or they could have bought the end, exactly, yeah, as well. But no, like an unbelievable effort, defensive effort. Throughout that team, Finn Russell, apart from his mistake and the yellow card with the trip, to have someone like him in your team, and Stuart Hogg, like real just cool, collected swagger, I guess. Finn Russell has, hasn't he? You know, obviously his best mates with Zeebo.
So obviously
Working off each other. But yeah, like to have, if you're a player on that team and you know you've got someone like that with a bit of X factor, he just played the game so well, didn't he, and put them back. And England just they're big carriers. I think like Billy Vunipolo didn't touch the ball in the first half, really. Johnny May, you know, wasn't really at the races, didn't see him getting the ball in space. So they just did a really, really good job of nullifying this big English power game. And the Scottish scrum as well. I mean, the Ferguson brothers, you know, the two boys were just outstanding, the prop and the back rower, number eight. So, yeah, just the Scottish team, fair play to them. They massive underdogs, and it was just brilliant to see them doing so well against our, obviously always nice to see England lose. So
yeah, a lot of people are taking it off Scotland and putting it back on England, and that, you know, it's obviously Saracens makes up quite a lot of their team, and has that had an impact on the English performance?
You'd imagine it would have, yeah. I think that the likes of Billy Vunipola and Owen Farrell didn't have the... they didn't probably have the bearing on the match that they normally would. Like, they're usually, you know, if those two guys play well for England, you generally win the game. And I thought, I don't know if Billy Vunipola looked that fit, because he just hasn't played that much rugby, to be fair. And, you know, even a player as classy as Owen Farrell, if he hasn't played much rugby and you're going straight into even, like, a couple of league games, you know, he has played no rugby, so there's, you can do all the training you want, but until you get into a test match, like those lads, Finn Russell and all the Scottish guys have played an awful lot of rugby this year, and you could see that they were fit, they were hungry. But yeah, as Chris said, it was great to see. It just opens up the competition, because like people looked at that game and thought, that's going to be a bonus point for England. And you kind of thought the way the Scots do usually put it up against England, that it would be, you know, close for 50 minutes. But they hung in there, and really they probably deserved to win by more than that in the end. They deserved to win by another score or two. They put, I'm not sure, again, the stats were massively in this, the Scots' favour, between carries, metres gained. To be honest, I think for the competition it was nice, because England have been so successful in the last few years playing what I think is a negative brand of rugby. They kick a lot of the ball, they play an awful lot of 10-man rugby, and granted, they do have extremely dangerous backs when they get space off turnovers, but they don't play that much rugby otherwise, and I think they play a territory-based game that is, like, that has grown around their power runners, and the Scots play a lot of rugby, and it was just great to see them pull that off. And what about 38 years, I'd say they had... I'd say they had a nice few beers together in a controlled environment last night, but it'll be interesting to see how they get on against Wales, because both of them now have won their first two games. They probably weren't expecting to win their first two games, and it just makes the competition extremely interesting now.
Yeah, like Scotland almost played them at their own game with that kicking and that territory game and forcing them back onto their five, and maybe it was just moments of like amazing skill from Stuart Hogg, but he was phenomenal yesterday.
He was brilliant, and even you could, I think the way he captains the side, obviously the players all you know, have so much respect for him. He said the term he, or the word he keeps using, is belief, and that was a Scottish team that definitely believed going to Twickenham, which is such a daunting place to go to. But again, do you go, well, if there was 80,000 English fans there, could that would Scotland have had the belief to go if the English fans were there? So certainly nullifies the home advantage. I think before the Six Nations, like, was the home team usually wins by like 60% or something. I think this championship, it's no doubt it's going to play a factor. There's been a lot of talk on it, but no, like the Scottish big, in these test matches, you want your big players to step up and have big moments. And you know, your Johnny Gray, like how many lineouts did he steal? Yeah. You know, he was colossal. You know, so much talk about you know, Toji going into this, but it was Johnny Gray was fantastic. I think he could have been man of the match as well. So no, it's just, it is great to see, because the Scottish team. Certainly, I think most of us wouldn't have predicted that result, and I'm certainly glad to have been, I think most people are glad to be proven wrong that they were able to pull it off.
Yeah, I think there was a map on Twitter yesterday that showed like the whole of the UK shouting for Scotland yesterday, and I think Ireland were definitely the same.
The Scottish pubs, I mean, you just got to feel so sorry for Scottish
I know.
Pubs.
So would have made like, the money.
Oh my word, like
the pubs in Dublin.
Well, that's true. Sorry, the pubs in Dublin too. But yeah, I mean, imagine being in Edinburgh. Three Sisters watching that game. It's so sad. But, you know, hopefully the Scottish, if any Scottish people watch the podcast, they'll just have to make up for it.
I'm sure they did it.
Finn Russell, as we know, like, plays with such flair. We've seen so many magic moments from him in the past, both at club and with his country. What was he thinking for the drop goal?
Yeah, I actually didn't think he had that good a game. I saw there was an article written about him saying, you know, Russell orchestrates Scottish win. Hogg had an incredible game. Like, everything he touched was just, it was just, had one of those games. I think it summarised like how he's come on as a player. I think he's really matured as a player. I think when he first broke on, and probably his first few years with Scotland, he could make those amazing breaks, but he would often make pretty silly mistakes as well. Maybe won a game, like against Ireland, it was the one over the try line where he knocks it on by trying to put it down with one hand. But he had a brilliant game. He really led as a captain with everything he did. I think his decision-making as well. I think when they decided to go for the corner and take the points as well. But, you know, Finn Russell tried to go for that drop goal. He got a yellow card. And he also missed that penalty as well. That was probably kickable. So he didn't do them any favours. But he's just... Russell's just one of those players that I'm sure... Gregor Townsend just can't keep out of the team because he brings so much more to a game as a 10. He's got that flair. Your heart would be in your mouth though. Going into that last 10 minutes, he's trying that drop goal and it's just bouncing around like a football.
After all the hard work, but was it genuinely to stop that bonus point, the losing bonus point for England? Was that in the back of his mind?
You wouldn't know. No. I would have thought they were holding on to the ball pretty well. And I know that there was another... It was going to be a long 2 minutes doing that.
He did have some nice moments, though. He did pin them back at a few key moments during the game as well. And Sean Maitland, too. That must have been his best game
in a long time.
He was unbelievable. He was chasing balls. He reminded me of you, Ferg, back in your day, mate. chase balls. You know, he was hunting everything and making moments happen. I thought he was really good as well.
Path to 12. That's such a cool story. When I heard that they were talking during the game, the commentators saying that his father. So I know people know the backstory to this guy Redpath, who plays for Bath. So his father used to play for Scotland, and he had played for Scotland 7 times against England and lost all of the games. And his son could have qualified for the English senior team because he had played for the 20s. And he decided to play for Scotland, and he beats England in Twickenham for the first time ever playing them. So it's a pretty cool story there. But I thought he had a phenomenal game. He's going to be some player for a young lad to go in his first Test match against such a physical side. And he was getting over the gain line, making smart decisions. Seems like a tough lad as well. He could be a real shining star for the rest of the tournament for them.
Next up, I suppose, next weekend is... On St. Valentine's Day is Ireland versus France. It's not going to be an easy one after that great French performance at the weekend.
Nope, they'll be coming to Dublin pretty confident. French, obviously, in the past, we always say to the French travel. I think without the Irish fan base there as a bit of intimidation, it certainly levels it again. The pond was just unbelievable. So if you've got someone like that in your team, setting the tempo and bossing people and just pulling off bits of magic, we're going to have to really bring in our really good performance. And I wonder how Ireland will approach this week. Will they be focusing too much on this French team, or do they get back to what is making Ireland good at being Ireland and not worrying too much about the opposition? Because the French pack, the French back row, Levan, the new captain, was outstanding, leading. It's just a new French year, isn't it? And what they did last in the Autumn Nations with their younger side, should have beaten England. It's going to be a really tough challenge. And it's when you lose your first game in Six Nations, you're climbing Everest, and you've got to you just got to get back on the horse as quickly as possible. The French, I don't know what injuries profile they have and who's going to be coming back, and because they were missing a few key players. But it's going to be a really, tough day for Ireland to make sure we get a win at home.
Will Ireland going in as underdogs into this game benefit them? They went into the Welsh game pretty much favourites. Did that go against them?
I wouldn't say it went against them, because I think that psychology would have been knocked out of them by Paul O'Connell, definitely, and probably Andy Farrell during the week, if there was any sort of complacency like that, which I'm sure there wasn't. But it's just interesting. We would have been, favourites going over to Cardiff. I think we've only won... the last time we had won there was 2013, wasn't it? It was quite a while ago, so it's a very tough place to go, regardless of what Welsh team is being picked. But in terms of this week, very tough to bounce back after losing that way. But I think that hurt will be harnessed in the right way when you've got a Paul O'Connell in there who's been through it before. He'll know what conversations to be having with certain guys, which guys to put an arm around and be like, listen, you could have done this better, but this is a huge week. They can still win the competition. The competition is wide open, so very disappointing. But you got to remember, you're playing against a test side for you know, 67 minutes. You're playing against a test side, a good test side for 67 minutes away from home with 14 men. It's next to impossible to win the game. So, like, bearing that in mind, we still should have won the game. So there's an awful lot of, I think there's, after the 24 hours passes, I think the public will, and generally even the players will realise, you know, how brave and how good a performance that was, taking everything into account. So I think the French, their tails will be up, and I think if there's any time to get them, it is at that time. I think the French are a dangerous team when they're a wounded animal, and they're not at the moment. They've just come off a relatively easy test match against Italy, so hopefully that'll work in our favour.
Yeah, how hard is it as a player knowing that you got thrashed out of the game, you weren't up for it, you weren't good enough, as opposed to just losing by the bare minimum? It makes it easier to get up the next day and train knowing that, you know, you were there. You were there, thereabouts. You were almost good enough.
Yeah, I mean, it's really difficult, isn't it? Like, as I said, I felt that the team will be galvanised tonight. You know, they'll be very much, you know, probably saying, right, we are just tightening up, not listening to outside noise. This is what it's about. A short week, which, okay, we'll be sore, but it means they get back out quicker. So, yeah, like, losing like that, it is tough, but... Yeah, it kind of does offers a wee bit of solace that they give it their all. As I said, they went to the well. It just, you know, as I said, it was just a wee bit off, pulling off a magical comeback. So they've just got to stay positive, you know, they really do. But it is, losing your first game just really makes it that so much more harder to stamp yourself on this tournament.
Ferg, you played against France in the 2012 and 2013 championships. What's it like going facing those French teams?
Yeah, it's tough facing them home or away, particularly in Paris, as Chris would tell you, with that crowd, the loudest crowd in the competition when they get going over there. But they're a tough side to predict. When we were playing them, probably tougher. I think they've got more structure, but at the same time, they're a better side now. They've, with that structure, they've got Sean Edwards, who's leading their defence. Their defence, I think... The summary of the way the French have changed would be how they are in defence, definitely. I think that the fact that they don't have guys walking when people miss tackles, you know, when kicks go over their heads, you see guys sprinting back. They seem to have a culture now where they work hard for each other. So they've got that French flair, but then they work their socks off for each other, which is, you know, you never thought you'd be saying about the French, but they're one of the hardest working teams in the competition. So, and they're defence has turned into a real strength for them. So I think if Ireland can get a dry day, hopefully we can, because they'll be a tough team to break down if it's wet, because you won't be able to shift the ball past the point of contact very far.
Both of you played in the game against France that was actually called off. Were you over in France or was it in Ireland at the time? And did you train away or did you go on a night out after it?
No, I was over as 24th man, and it was in Paris. So, I mean, it was ridiculous. Like, we were warming up, and the ground was rock hard. Like, there was no way that game was going to be played. But we warmed up. 80,000 people had got the stadium. We were in the huddle. I was 24th man, so I was actually just the side, and everyone was in the huddle. Paul O'Connell, the captain, you know, he was giving us one of his emotional ones, which was great. You know, he picked and chose whenever he, like, properly went, you know, tears in the eyes and talked about his, you know, it was more than just rugby. It was his, you know, about your family and your kids and your friends. And everyone was so pumped up. And next minute, you know, one of the ground staff or one of the management came over and tapped his shoulder and just said, oh, by the way, there's no game. So bizarre moment, you know, 80,000 fans waiting there for a game. So we actually... You know, bizarre situation. We actually, a lot of us went out and played touch against the French for a while, if you remember that.
Which we won, actually.
We won that game. Yeah, we won the touch game. Brilliant, yeah. But then the fans all...
Did you actually get to play as 24th man?
Well, I got to play. They brought me in, of course. I was burning the touch rugby then. But no, we played that for like 5-10 minutes and then loads of the fans stayed in the ground to watch. And they were cheering us. It was brilliant. But then
it's like the halftime show when all the little kids come.
Yeah, but then
on.
They were like, they were like, get everyone out. They all had to leave, so they cancelled that touch game, which was disappointment. And then we went back to the hotel. Everyone was obviously, you know, you're taking caffeine gum.
Yeah, you're wired.
You're wired, and it's hard to sleep anyway after the game. So I remember Polly just saying, "Look, this is not ideal, but this is a chance for us all to, you know, have a few beers, get to know each other a bit better." And we had a brilliant team social out in Paris. Bizarre that there was no game. Just one of those great stories and one of those nights out in Paris that should never happen but did, and it was brilliant.
Yeah.
Fergus, you came off the bench when Johnny Sexton got that drop goal. You were on the pitch when that moment happened. Is that up there as one of the memories that stands out in your mind?
Well, it was. So I got picked for that 23. I was the 23rd man picked for that late in the week that week. So we went over to Paris and I came on. So I remember the French had a kick on the 15 meter line and they missed it to go, I think, 5 points ahead, and they were two ahead at the time, and he missed a very kickable kick, and Johnny got the ball straight away, ran up to the 22. The French weren't set properly, and he short kick off to Dev, and we just started building phases from there. I'd come on the 73rd minute, so it was probably around the 78th or so. It was coming up to the last couple of minutes of the match anyway, and we just started going through phase upon phase, and when you first get it off that Dev towered above and caught the ball, you're kind of going, all the players are probably in their head, thinking, we to break this French team down and get down. There was a wet day. The ball wasn't very easy to pass. But people just started minding the ball. Our ruck was very good. Everyone just dialed in. And we were struggling to break them down around the R10 meter line. And Johnny tried a crossfield kick to Keith Earls, who caught it. And that just got our tails up. We got over the gain line a few times, and I think it was 41 phases. And I think I was either in a ruck. Yeah, I think it was in a ruck, and Conor Murray threw the ball back and kicked it. Just look at it soaring through the air. And honestly, I was only on the pitch for 7 minutes, but when that went over, it was the best feeling I've ever had on a rugby pitch in my life. It literally was. I'm talking as good as the feeling after having our first child. And my wife won't be happy I said that, but genuinely, it was just incredible. Johnny running back, the whistle had gone, and obviously it was in Paris, so there was a silence in most of the stadium, and then pockets of Irish screaming, and we just jumped massive pylon on Johnny. But there's some brilliant pictures of us all jumping on top of Johnny there, but what a memory for him to have, because I think today shows you the Six Nations. You need luck to, one, win it, but you need an awful lot of luck along the way to win a Grand Slam. And not to say that kick from Johnny was luck, but I suppose if you go through the 41 phases, what could and couldn't have gone wrong, things need to fall into place for you. And that day, so when something like that happens in a game at the start of Six Nations, you can start, it just builds belief. And that's the most unfortunate thing, I think, today about the Irish performance, is that that belief would have been there after going down to 14 men, but just wasn't to be.
It's great that you have a moment like that, and it stands out of all the games you've played. And you've played a lot of rugby, and I think a lot of Irish fans will cherish that moment too. I know as a fan, I do. And that's what the Six Nations really is about.
I did nothing. All I did was clean out a
few. You meant 41,
yeah, what were you doing
41 phases, how many rucks were you in?
probably around 20.
And why did he not kick to you, crossfield kick? He looked up, oh no, we're going to go.
He's not going to kick at someone in a ruck, Chris.
What were you doing as a ruck, in a ruck as a winger anyway? What are you supposed
very
to be
important,
doing?
Very important, Eimear.
It really is. I suppose a talking point this week, ahead of, or separate to the Six Nations, is the player contract negotiations that are going, and it must be lingering at the back of the players' minds. Would they be sorted at this stage? Obviously, Ulster have got their ass in gear, and they're really, there's a lot of people signed on there. Is that in the back of their minds at the moment, or has the deal been done?
I think, it's obviously surprising that we've gotten to February and the start of the Six Nations, and there still isn't probably a bit more higher profile news with signings. It probably reinforces the struggle that the rugby in general is in. As a player, when I was playing, there's no doubt about it, when you were up from contract, it was in the back of your mind. No matter what the players, as you go to your media sessions, you won't tell. No, don't think about it. Only focus about the rugby. But you go to bed and you go, well, what if I wake up on the next day and getting injured or, you know, have a poor performance like that. These things do play in your mind. So, disappointing that there's not more news, I guess. As you mentioned, Ulster have, you've been releasing some very positive news, but I think it's just really challenging times, and there's going to be guys that unfortunately are going to get tougher news, maybe, you know, expecting terms that, you know, aren't going to be available for them. So it's just a fact of life at the moment that we're in, that everyone's battling that front at the moment.
Had you ever considered, you know, going abroad as a player when you were in contract negotiations?
A lot of it is...
A couple of big money moves to France.
Oh, man, you're kidding me? I was desperate for France, but no, never France. France would be the end of me, sure, the red wine and the croissants and the baguettes. No, I never got the chance of that. The three clubs that I, at times were close to going to was, firstly, Exeter when they weren't in the Premiership. Gareth Steenson and Ian Whitten were there, and... That was our team. London Irish was another team I talked to at one stage, but the one that might surprise some of your viewers is I was at one stage very close to going to Leinster. So it was certainly a ploy for me at that stage with negotiations with Ulster. But this would have been maybe 2009, 2008, and it was after Christmas anyway. So usually, you know, if you're playing well, most contracts usually obviously would have been done by, you know, even September, October, latest November. You're sitting at Christmas time, you know, you've got your new contract usually done. Leinster at that stage, Shane Jennings was getting on a wee bit, and they were like, the conversation happened. As Chris hasn't got signed yet from Ulster, would he be interested? So I made the journey to Dublin. I was just a ploy. It was David Humphreys at the time doing negotiating, and if you know David Humphreys, he's a tough negotiator. And it was just, to be honest, a way of me using that to say, right, let's get this in gear. And I remember driving home after having the chat with Guy Easterby at the time and going, geez, this actually could be pretty exciting. Now, obviously, I'm so glad that it didn't happen, and wonderful career with Ulster, and that was where my heart is, and I wouldn't have changed it. But just Isaac Boss and Ed O'Donoghue, that was the year that they left as well. That was the only time that I was nearly going, but my heart was always with Ulster and never moved, and I'm sure you must have had tons.
Was that why Draco punched you in the face that time in the final?
I thought we couldn't talk about that.
Oh, we can now.
Yeah, can we talk about it now? Yeah. Jeez. He apologised, so it's all fine. Add to the injury list of the nose, the punch from Draco in the nose a long time ago. People probably didn't...
Tell you what, if the sighting officer was around these days, that would have been a few weeks.
Well, so the context of that was it was in the final, right? Or semi-final. Yeah, and final. We were about to fly out to New Zealand 2 days later. So I was cheating. I pulled Draco back. Leinster made another line break again, probably Ferg. And I had pulled Draco back, and he obviously didn't like it, rightly so, and he... through a dig, hit me in the nose. So I went, brilliant, this is definitely going to be yellow card or whatever at that stage. And it was dismissed, game on. So after the game, we lose, as usual, in the RDS, great. And the sighting commissioner came in and said, he punched you. And I went, yeah, he did. And he goes, we're flying out to New Zealand in 2 days. And and I'm going... If I push this, I'm going to be the most
hated person. The whole country will hate you.
We're going to go to New Zealand, but without Draco, because of me. So, that
instead
was...
Instead of getting beaten by 60 points, we would have got beaten by 120 points.
Exactly. So, no, didn't push that one.
Did France ever tempt you?
Not so much France. I talked to a couple of English clubs along the way. Again, probably doing it... as a bit of a bait for Leinster to keep me and probably improve my negotiation at the time. I suppose now that I'm retired, there's probably a small part of me. I remember when Brad Thorne came to Leinster for that year in 2012, he used to always say to the younger guys at the time, you should go away, go down under and test yourself. He said, that's what I found is I've gotten so many more years out of my careers because I've had to go into new environments, even with his reputation and having to prove himself to new groups of guys. Mm-hmm. And I think in one way it can, lengthen your career as well, because you have to kind of prove yourself to new guys and improve and all the rest. But I never did it. Yeah, never did it. I'll relay what Chris had said. I'm happy I didn't. I'm very happy with the the stint and feel lucky with the stint I had in Leinster. But back to the negotiation stuff that you had talked about earlier on, I definitely found a few times, because unlike for people that at home that are listening or watching, unlike, say, you know, the corporate world, or you go on a job where this is your contract for the year and it's just done on a certain day, with rugby contracts, it's very fluid. So it starts at the top. So the top guys who are on central contracts would get calls, say, some of them would get calls in August without COVID, and that their deal might be done in September time, whereas the guys who are lower down the rung and the food chain, they could be talking or uncertain about their futures in January. And all that time, guys are playing, and as Chris said, you know, when you are going through the negotiation process and you're in the midst of it, you're talking to an agent, you might be talking to your wife or your parents about trying to get advice and trying to block that out when you're playing, because for the player, the longer it goes on, all of the power lies in the club or the IRFU's hand, because you can get injured, you can play badly, you know, other clubs might not be interested in you. So it could be quite a tough time for guys. So I'd say these guys at the moment that haven't got their contracts sorted yet, I really feel for them, because it's been, you know, it's been months, and you know, some guys might have young families or mortgages, and they're trying to get certainty on going forward. And I just hope that most of the guys do manage to get some clarity on it, you know, as soon as possible.
And do you think that it's that they haven't been announced yet, or that they just haven't actually been organised yet?
Well, I hope it hasn't been, and I hope it is a case of that where it's all been done and just hasn't been announced. But I don't know why they wouldn't have. But I just think, as I'm sure for agree from being out of the game, you know, it finishes so quickly. You know, I was lucky. I retired as 34, but actually, it just looking back now, I'm out of the game for 2 years, and it is so short. Mm. And everyone, different parts of your career, no matter where you are, it matters. You know, you need to get security. You're, as Ferg said, you're committed to you know, you're trying to plan your life after rugby, and it's just so important to maximise your time playing, because it is a business. And hopefully we'll get, you know, it's just surprising that some of the really high profile players haven't been done yet. And yeah, I think for fans and for the players and for Irish rugby, it'll be good to hopefully get some.
But by the sounds of what Johnny was saying, like, he was saying that he hasn't been sorted, and maybe he wouldn't say it publicly, but like, I mean, if they're not getting Johnny Sexton's contract sorted at this stage, like, when are the other guys going to get sorted, really? You know, and I'm sure some guys have signed on, but and I know it's a, I know it's a tough time for the unions, but you've got to expect that you've got to secure the bigger players and make sure they stay in the country and they don't go abroad. I think it's very important to keep them here, because if they're not here, they're not going to play for Ireland.
Yeah, and do you see that rule changing if they do end up getting more money and gain financially in other countries, because that's where the money is essentially?
Like, well, it's an unwritten rule. My opinion is I think it's something that has to be, you know, Simon Zeebo, you know, you're sitting there going like, I know Keaton's been brilliant, but like, there's a player that is just so, you know, add something, and they, you know, it's a short flight home for him when he's required. And I just think that maybe the only thing is that there isn't as much, you know, if there was so much more demand for players at the moment than all the other countries, then the Irish contracts would be done. But there clearly isn't as much. So it's a power game. It's the only people are really going to know is obviously the agents and the powers that be. So I think that the foreign policy rule, of course you want to keep players here, but if it means that some other place is footing the bill, then I think it has to move that way. I just think that's the way the game...
I think it's a pity, though, because you do look at some guys that are flourishing abroad. You know, obviously, the likes of Dunica Ryan, his career has, you know, he's reinvented himself almost going over there. And it's almost like the hot weather has just turned him into a younger man. He's playing great. Simon Zeebo playing great. A young guy that left... a young for his position. Brian Byrne left Leinster last year in an uncertain situation in COVID, and he's gone over and he's starting for a team that is playing the best rugby in the Premiership, and they're on top of the league in Bristol. He's a great example. You know, didn't get his opportunities that through injury and selection in Ireland, but he's someone that should be looked at as well. Like, well, why shouldn't he be? So, I mean, it's going to be interesting to see how the contract situation works out, because if guys do disperse and go to foreign waters, yeah, then maybe that ruling will have to change.
You have to have the best players playing for you, whether they're in the country, whether they're not. And if there is a mass exodus of like those guys on the centralised contracts, well, they're going to have to it's an unwritten rule, essentially. It's actually, not an official rule, but they'll have to just look at it and think,
And you can learn so much off, like you mentioned, Donegal Ryan. Like, imagine him coming back when he's required. How much you learn from him, from what he's learning abroad too. So it's all about that, the knowledge base and the way things are, the simple things about how they, conversation about how they run their training week. How they run their line-out sessions. It's knowledge that you're just desperate for.
Yeah.
And to go from different places, I think it could only be a good thing.
It's like when the environments come together with, over time, when guys do open up. Obviously, it's a bit cagey initially when you come in from all the four provinces. But when guys in camp over these coming weeks, they'll be sharing ideas that were working for them in Munster, Ulster, Connacht and Leinster. And if you had six other touch points, as in six other teams, good teams around Europe that you're taking other ideas from and bringing them all to the table, surely it's only going to be better.
Yeah.
So
I think of what Eason Asaiwa would have brought to Leinster from his experience in New Zealand, or what Albie Mathieson would bring to Ulster.
Ruan Pina.
Yeah.
He was all right.
Yeah.
Huh?
He was okay. He was okay player. Yeah.
It's definitely something to be looked at. Anyway, we thought it would be a great idea to look at something that caught our eye on social media this week. That could be something funny, thought-provoking, shocking or downright brilliant that we've seen on Twitter, Instagram or on our House of Rugby Facebook page. We liked this tweet from BBC reporter Chris Henson after Scotland's win over England. Scotland players' stock going through the roof GameStop style after that win in front of Warren Gatland. And we finished with a picture that was doing the rounds everywhere. Even on our Facebook group was Antoine Dupont with his feet up on the France bench after another superb performance. Is he the best player in the world at the moment?
Well, him and Cheslin Colby, I guess, are the two. Totally just depends on the position. But yes, I would hate to play against him at the moment. Things just happen around him. And he's just oozes confidence and things happen around him. So I'd say he probably is.
Probably. Well, cheers to everybody for watching and for listening today. A big thank you to producer Pat, Paul, Dermot, Anthony and everyone that helped in getting this show together. This has been House of Rugby Ireland here on Joe. Slán go fóill.
House of Rugby Ireland here on Joe. Game changed.